Hey, deserving listeners, let's continue following the Ruby Frankie Jody Hildebrandt news story. Let's watch.
Okay, I fear that he may have become corrupted, particularly the app TikTok that I hear from other women in my church is propagating homosexual lifestyle. Yes.
All right, so to catch you up, I think Jody is live streaming or something, and she is answering someone's concern, someone's question about their child having been influenced by TikTok and society to be gay, I think, is the context. And before going forward, I just want to remind everyone that I'm watching the YouTube channel called the Mormon Stories Podcast.
That I hear from other women in my church is propagating homosexual lifestyle. Yes, that's true. It is. I hold myself partly to blame for this, as I allowed him free access to his smartphone since age 15. Oh, Mom. So you said I feel partly to blame. This isn't about blame. Blame's not going to help you. You are culpable. You are responsible.
This isn't about blame, but you're to blame. That's what charismatic leaders will do. They will brainwash through language shenanigans and gymnastics. Look, this isn't about blame, but you are culpable. Let's look up the definition of culpable. Culpable, meaning deserving blame. Very simple. It is an adjective. The definition is deserving blame. So, you know, you're not to blame. It's not about blame, but you are deserving of blame. Let's rewatch that.
Oh, Mom. So you said I feel partly to blame. This isn't about blame. Blame's not going to help you. You are culpable. You are responsible. You put into...
And it just makes you wonder what's the strategy there or the bias. I wouldn't be surprised if we watch a lot of Jody's content that, or her way of helping, quote unquote, is that she has to keep people small and made to feel stupid and belittling people. So the statement from the person is, hey, I feel like I'm to blame. For her to agree with that, just openly, yes, you are to blame, it gives the person that's calling in or the client power because Jody is saying you're right, essentially. But there could be this bias or this tendency for her to always oppose the person regardless of what they say, and then just use different language to get at what essentially is what they were saying. I don't know. But or another thing is taking the edge off of blame, you know, saying you're not to blame, but you are culpable, as if culpable is a lesser insulting word or something. I don't know.
Boy's hand, something very dangerous, much more dangerous than a weapon, much more dangerous than a gun. You know, people say, well, guns kill. Well, cell phones will kill your spirit.
Yeah. Cell phones and everything on it, they are very, very powerful. And you, Jody, have been spreading your horrific notions around the world through a cell phone. Yeah. So true. Just think of this notion that somehow a TikTok made my son gay. that's what it says on the thing, right? I didn't even see that, or maybe I subconsciously did. So yeah, maybe TikTok did help an individual who is gay to come out as gay or feel like it's okay to be gay or to connect them with other gay people so that they could have a community. Yeah, but TikTok didn't make your son gay. Just imagine the amount of misinformation that you'd have to continually hold on to think this way. It's like flat earthers. It's so ridiculous. If this is true, that TikTok makes people gay, or liberals make people gay, or gay people make people gay, then you would have, like, everyone would be gay because everyone's on TikTok, right? But no, you just see there's a percentage of people. And so it seems like there's a percentage of people that are gay and percentage of people that are hetero, and there are percentage of people in the middle somewhere, percentage of people who are bi, percentage of people who are trans, percentage of people who are cis, percentage of, you know, there's It's percentages, and that's the way it seems. And when you provide freedom and laws that protect people, then people will emerge into adulthood having discovered who they are and perhaps sharing that identity with the others in the world. And that's where we're headed. We're far from that complete liberty and freedom, but we're a lot better than we were before. So this whole notion that you could just have that TikTok could turn you gay. I mean, if anything, TikTok probably has a lot of homophobia on it, to be honest. I don't know that, but I wouldn't be surprised if the overall, if you just counted all the videos on TikTok, that it would tend to lean on the homophobic side, because even though there's a lot of young people on TikTok and certainly a lot of activists that are fighting the good fight, our culture is still homophobic and TikTok reflects our culture. And so I'm guessing that that's going to happen. So, yeah, anyway.
Is your husband upset? Are you upset? Yes, you are. It's not just about that he's made this declaration. It's also that you've been being lied to. Your hard-earned, you know, the evidence of how you've been taking care of him, like the money you've spent, the roof over his head, the work that both of you've done to...
So some context, I believe that someone is asking Jody a question regarding that her and her husband are upset that their child is gay or trans or something.
Your hard-earned, you know, the evidence of how you've been taking care of him, like the money you've spent, the roof over his head, the work that both of you've done to give him the things that will make his life comfortable, he has exploited all of those things. And he has been going places that are very dangerous and destructive to his little soul. Now, if he's an adult, or when he becomes adult and he chooses to behave in whatever lifestyle he chooses to behave in.
I love that word, lifestyle. You never call it a heterosexual cisgender lifestyle, right?
Your job is to guide them in principles of truth. And,
yeah, your truth. But the truth in reality is that gay people exist and they're fine. And we shouldn't be oppressing them or thinking that it's a temporary lifestyle. So your truth is this backward, unscientific, ridiculous, harmful bigotry. That's your truth. But the truth is not your truth.
You can't say he's being defiant. That's just who he is. And the truth is that that's not who he is. There's not a soul on the planet that was born towards something that is violates principles of truth. So none of us are born to kill. None of us are born to be attracted to animals. We're not attracted to want to be sexual with the earth.
Sexual with, what do you, earth? Who, what? So, yeah. It's so weird. So these religious cults, they're so oppressive to sexuality, and yet their mind is so sexually creative. It just points to, like, you think about sex a lot. probably because you're suppressing so much. And of course, there are allegations or suspicions that she is gay, or that she is gay herself. And this whole lifestyle is one big defense against that of some sort. I don't know that, of course. But yeah, it's an old trope of conservatives and right-wingers and fundamentalists of various different sorts to equate being gay with being a pedophile, with having sex with animals, with being promiscuous. But it's just heartbreaking to think that you have a young person who comes out as gay to their parents, and the parents ask Jody for advice, and Jody, and presumably those parents respect and look up to Jody, and Jody just feeds them all this nonsense, and then the parents are going to go back and reject and harm this young person. It's just, I mean, just think about that young person and what they're going through, regardless of Jody, and then you add Jody. And by the way, this is absolutely outside the standard of practice and would absolutely get your license at least looked into. I mean, this is just one of her hundreds of videos that have this sort of material. And it is one of those hardline things, actually, in our society. And there's, I've done whole episodes on this topic, and it's changing every year. But generally speaking, in the last number of years, the various professions in the United States have come forward and publicly stated that it is unethical and outside the standard of practice and unscientific to hold the idea that LGBTQIA people can be reformed. You know, you can pray away the gay, or you can therapize away the gay or the trans or whatever.
And we're not drawn, if you will, to the same gender. Now, can we override that? Yeah, we can.
No, you can't. It's been stabbed. 30 years ago, if someone said this, I'd be like, well, you're dumb, but I don't know. I guess I would say, well, that is a prevalent idea. In 2023, or whenever this was made, I'm guessing it was recently, that in modern times that you would have a clinician say this sort of nonsense is just incredible. I mean, just think about the amount of brainwashing that you would have to be involved in, and the amount of trickery and gymnastics you'd have to do in your mind. Just, it's just astonishing. Just and just so sad and pathetic. I wish I had a time machine. I could skip forward like however many years it's required, you know, 50 years, 500 years, and just could put all this behind us. Can we just put this behind us?
And it's called lust. I can lust after anything. And lust is inside marriages between men and women. Lust is inside marriages between men and men and women and women. I mean, I call it marriage because now it's legal on the planet to be married. People can be lustful with animals. They can be lustful with inanimate objects. You can lust after anything. It's a form of selfishness and aggression and hatred. Hatred primarily towards myself.
What? Isn't it okay for heterosexual, Mormon-sanctioned marriages? Well, oh, okay. Well, yeah, right. So when they go really far into the echo chamber or cult, then they will say it's even wrong to have lust for your partner, because as a cult, we need to control every aspect of your life, and we need to keep you in a constant state of deprivation and shame so that we can control you. So you should only be having sex for procreation, and it should be about God and all that kind of stuff. And you should never be lusting.
Six children.
Eve has been amazingly well behaved for being in town.
But you yelled at me.
Shh. The fact that I yell at my kids is a secret. We don't want our viewers to know.
Okay, so I'm watching clips from the Law and Crime Trial Network on YouTube, and we just saw a little snippet. The more snippets I see, it just makes me wonder how many snippets are there. I think it's a good chance, and I think people are telling me that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of clips that are all pointing in the direction of abuse, some of them exhibiting abuse in the actual video.
Once boasting more than 2 million followers, the YouTube page is now defunct. Kester says the family hasn't created content for the channel in more than a year.
I don't think anything's been posted on that for pretty close to a year and a half.
Okay, so they are interviewing the father's attorney, Kevin Frankie's attorney, and he's saying that Kevin, the father, hadn't seen the children in over a year. And it's hard to know the circumstances around that. How hard was the dad fighting to see the kids? I don't know. But the claim by Kevin Frankie is that he didn't know about any of the abuse that was happening. And I find that hard to believe, given that it was happening right in front of him, and it was on, you know, while he was still in the home, and he's on camera, and those videos are on the internet. So even if he wasn't in the room and those things are happening as they're being filmed, they're on the internet. So I'm guessing what he means is he didn't know about the severe abuse that was happening. It appears that abuse was happening on a lower scale. We're also learning that, and I'm guessing some of you already know this, but in terms of the timeline, it kind of looks like that Ruby Frankie had this YouTube channel, 8 Passengers, and was possibly abusing the children and preaching this very harsh, if not abusive, parenting style. but it wasn't at the level of Jody Hildebrandt. And then at some point, Ruby Frankie meets up with Jody Hildebrandt, maybe because the marriage wasn't going through a good time, or who knows. But and then at some point becomes indoctrinated into Jody Hildebrandt's way of thinking. Jesse Hildebrandt, Jody Hildebrandt's brother's child, said as much that, look, this is not a story about Ruby Frankie. This is a story about Jody Hildebrandt. And Ruby Frankie just got caught up in the Jody Hildebrandt cult. And then Jody Hildebrandt convinces Ruby Frankie to utilize her clout on the internet to, bolster Jody Hildebrandt's brand or career, to the point where, and of course, this is all just me making up a story. I don't know. I don't see any data that exactly points to this, but the timeline seems to add up that at some point Jody got Ruby and all the children underneath her cult or her high control group. And maybe Jody was suspicious of Kevin and somehow got Ruby to ostracize Kevin or something, and then influenced Ruby to shut down her YouTube channel, because that's her, the Eight Passengers YouTube channel also stopped posting around this time. So a lot of changes happened about a year ago. Apparently, she moved all the kids to Southern Utah to live in this very remote house of Jody Hildebrandt.
While they did their investigation, they weren't letting anyone have contact with the kids.
But Kester maintains Kevin Frankie had no idea his children were in trouble.
And some critics are saying, how could you not know? How could you spend this much time without speaking to your kids? What does he have to say about that?
He was following the advice of who he thought was a professional mental health expert, telling him to stay away. The only way to save his family was to stay apart from his family at that point, while he thought they were working toward reconciliation. He had no idea that there was this kind of abuse going on. She was telling him that everything was blissful and everything was wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's totally possible what Kevin is saying there, that he didn't know what was actually happening in Jody Hildebrandt's home. And if he did know, he would have done something different. I think that is actually possible. And that might actually be why Jody managed to get rid of Kevin, because Jody knew that Kevin wasn't brainwashable. Another element here, I don't know if I showed the clip, was the attorney was saying that in the beginning, when the family was still together and the parents were still together, that Jody and Ruby would go off, just the two of them, for days at a time and come back. And while the father was left at home with the kids. And for some people, that I guess might raise a suspicion that this is another example of how Jody Hildebrandt is engaging with someone's wife in a sexual relationship or a romantic relationship or a flirting relationship or something. I don't know if there's any hard data on this, but there are people that are wondering about that. He's saying that, and people are attacking the father, like, how could you possibly do this? And so according to the attorney, what Kevin is saying is, look, I was told to stay away because I was following the advice of this licensed mental health person. And but when you hear Jody talking, and if you're already brainwashed into a cult way of thinking anyway, it's not a stretch to imagine that Kevin would have been easily convinced. But that doesn't address the issue that I'm wondering about, which is, well, Kevin, what do you think about what was happening while you were living in the house? Because there appeared to have been, to a lesser extent, but still actual abuse or mistreatment or problematic parenting that was happening before you separated from your family. So I think that is another question that I think if I were an advocate for the children, that would be a question, because it looks like if things continue going down this road, that all the children will be returned to the father.
That, in conjunction with the fact she didn't tell him that she'd taken the kids to Southern Utah to be in Jody's home. He would have resisted that, but she didn't tell him. He was being advised by his mental health care professional to stay away from the family and not contact the kids.
Kester does say before his wife's arrest, Kevin Frankie received counseling from Hildebrandt.
During the separation, Kevin was attending men's groups that were facilitated by Jody. And during those groups, he was being downgraded and diminished and told how bad he was and that he needed to repent, and that the best way to repent was to not infect his family with his problems. And
wow, I mean, the wow, I can't wait for there to be a full scale documentary series about this, because, or a recreation series, or I mean, it's just mind blowing to think about that. Jody had a men's group, and he was recommended to be in it, sounds like. And so he obeys, and he's in it. And you can imagine, given that how successful Jody was as a cult leader, that she would perhaps begin the process of the group therapy with some things that Kevin could get behind to invite him in. And then once she's got her hooks into him, then she starts to tear him down and tear him down and tear him down, and using this truth versus distortion thing. And maybe the other group members are also terrified of her or in awe of Jody, and then influences him to stay away from the family. Yeah. You know, from the outside, you're just like, where was the dad? I don't understand. But when you hear that, you think, oof. And you could totally imagine that, right? And I wonder if Kevin is more susceptible to that kind of influence. I mean, anyone is susceptible. You know, if you watch this, you're like, oh, I wouldn't do that. In all likelihood, you would. Anyone is susceptible to this kind of brainwashing and mind control within a cult. It happens to the best of us. Anyway, so that's what Kevin is claiming. I don't, it's possible this is all just some a group of lies that Kevin is saying because he's trying to avoid getting in trouble, but yeah, you know, that is pretty interesting. And the elaborateness of Jody's scheme, was it that she was just ad-libbing it as she was going, or did she plan it all in advance? Where it's like, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that. I'm going to get this YouTuber who has millions of followers, and I'm going to manipulate her and indoctrinate her in this cult, and we're going to have, I'm going to make all this money, I'm going to spread the word, I'm going to run for president, I'm going to make parenting great again.
As Law and Crime Network reported, shocking allegations came out of a previous juvenile hearing when Ruby Frankie appeared virtually. She claimed one of her children started having problems at age 3 when they began looking at pornography. While Frankie didn't mention the child by name, she alleged her child sexually assaulted one of their younger siblings, which led to that child sexually assaulting other kids.
Yeah, so the first time I heard this, when I was watching the news coverage, I was confused because I was wondering, where is this coming from? Because it's not necessarily related to the situation at hand. So it sort of caught me off guard. And what I ended up talking about in my reaction was about how with the Duggar family, with Josh Duggar, also in a high-control cult religion, and there are hypotheses that are developed, including for myself, regarding how when you have a cult environment, particularly when it's so focused on suppression of sexuality and frequently talking about sex, that you could create a situation and that could be a breeding ground for sibling sexual abuse, you know, because of the insular nature, they're homeschooled, they have no outside contact, you know, if Josh had gone to a regular public middle school and had met girls, might it have gone differently? It's hard to know. Things are never that simple, but that's what I ended up talking about. But a lot of people in the comments section were saying, you probably should be skeptical of Ruby Frankie's claim after being arrested herself that one of her children were sexually abusing the younger children, because it could be a smokescreen that she's putting up as a way to somehow defer blame or distract people or something, or make her look like she's a victim of something. I don't know. And it could also be used as a way to discredit one of her victims if she says that, well, you know, they're saying that I abused them, but really they were abusing other people, so you should not be listening to that child. Also, we should consider the fact that Ruby Frankie and other people in her high control religious group have some pretty weird, twisted, backward ideas about sexuality, and they see a lot of things as being quote-unquote abusive or victimizing of other people. Okay, so I want to thank deserving listener Louise for sending me that video to react to regarding Kevin's lawyer. I just want to finish here by going over some more comments on YouTube. Me Marie says, to shed a bit more light on Jody's licensure, she was a fully licensed and credentialed therapist, and as others have mentioned, she frequently receives referrals from bishops in the area. She had her license suspended for a period of time due to a number of ethical infractions, not the least of which being that she broke confidentiality and relayed confidential personal information shared by her client, a BYU student, to the BYU Honor Code office, which ultimately got the student dismissed from the university. Okay, so I'm just reading someone's comment. I don't know if this is accurate, but we're hearing that Jody allegedly broke confidentiality and spoke to the Brigham Young University, which, if you don't know, it's a Mormon university in Utah. And Jody had a client and obtained information and shared that information with the university, which ultimately got the student dismissed from the university. So I'd have to see the case. I'd have to review exactly what happened. On the face of it, it looks like a slam dunk indication of an ethical violation, but there are times when us therapists are compelled to break confidentiality, and there are times when it's in the gray zone and you don't necessarily know what to do and you might make the wrong call. So we don't know. But given everything that we've seen and heard, you know, there's a pretty good chance that what she was doing was she was either working in concert with the parents. I don't know, just throwing it out here that you have a student who, college student who might be drinking and have premarital sex and discloses that to Jody and maybe says a few other things like, I don't know, maybe he cheated on a test or something. And because of Jody's authoritarian ways or her brainwashing or whatever, either working in concert with the parents or just out of her own a way of thinking, she thinks that the university needs to know that he cheated on the test and then the kid gets kicked out of school. Who knows? But at the very least, what we're hearing from Mie Marie is that she had her license suspended for a period of time prior to all these things due to a number of ethical violations, which is astounding that she still had her license. And I've been saying this throughout the series and also from the beginning of this podcast that government agencies like the departments of licensing, they usually react way too slow with way too little. So it's a problem, and it appears to have been a problem here. I don't know. But another person on YouTube commented, their handle is Wild Purple Panda, and they say that Jody was a trained licensed therapist. Then she lost her license for 18 months for breach of confidentiality and having a dual relationship with a patient. So if you don't know what a dual relationship is, it's when a therapist has a relationship as a therapist and client. That's one particular kind of relationship. And then they have another relationship with the client. Like if I had a client who I hired as my accountant, then that would be a dual relationship because I have a relationship with my client as a client and I have a relationship with my client as my accountant. And generally speaking, this is considered unethical, potentially unethical violation. There's a lot of nuance, but at the very least, what Wild Purple Panda is saying is that she lost her license for 18 months, which is, you know, quite a thing. When the Department of Licensing will take the or suspend it or revoke it for 18 months, that says something. I mean, it has to be something pretty severe. Like with Jordan Peterson and all the things he did, they didn't threaten that. They just said, you have to go to this class. That was all he had to do. They could have easily just taken the whole license away, given the things that I've seen. But to have your license taken away for 18 months, I'm guessing that the allegations and the charges were at least moderate, if not severe, and that the evidence was pretty clear. So she had a dual relationship with a patient. I think some people might wonder, maybe even people have data around this, that it might have been having a romantic or sexual relationship with one of the wives that we've heard about. I don't want to spread rumors, but people have been telling me things along those lines. And then going on with the comment, she had to complete 20 other criteria and get through the 18 months to get the license back. She did it. Now she has voluntarily surrendered her license. Oh, so Purple Panda is referencing 20 other criteria. I'm guessing that references a number of different tasks and hoops that Jody had to jump through in order to get her license back. Often that involves trainings and supervision, maybe even a public statement of some sort. I don't know. Ludi Price says, in her self-published book, Jodi talks about being neglected and sexually abused as a child. It's hard not to draw a correlation between that, her obsession with sex as sin, and her hatred of men, and possibly also her being queer, if that is indeed what she is. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. It stands to reason, given everything we're seeing, right? Now, of course, there's a lot of ways that people will respond to childhood abuse. This response that Jodi exhibits is pretty rare. Moving on, T-Rex 33 says, I was stunned as I heard Ruby recall overhearing her daughter's prayer, asking God to please help her to survive. Ruby thought it was hilarious. Such a sick mentality. Yeah, I was wondering about the volume of clips that are out there that exhibit the abuse that was happening. And from the sound of it, this sounds like maybe it was done before Ruby was with Jodi. And at least we're hearing from T-Rex that Ruby recalls overhearing. She's like, oh yeah, last night my daughter was in her bedroom and I overheard her praying to God to please help her survive my parenting. And you know, if I just heard that from a parent or someone, I wouldn't necessarily know what that meant. If you have kids, they can feel quite put upon even when they're not being abused, right? That you buy them three toys, but you don't buy them that fourth toy. And some kids, not all kids, but some kids will, you know, overreact to that. They will think that their life is over. And might a child say like, oh, please God, help me survive the fact that I only got three toys and not four. And I'm not saying kids are bad people. I'm just saying that, you know, being a kid, it's emotional. There's a lot of emotional ups and downs. And there's a lot of ways that kids will deal with it. But given everything that we know, of course, it's heartbreaking to think that a daughter, one of the abused children, would be praying to God, like, please help me to survive this life or my mom or Jodi or whatever. And not only that, but that Ruby would overhear that and laugh about it and think it's hilarious, and then to talk about it on the internet. And then for the internet, for YouTube, and for the government to do nothing about it, even though lots of people, including people with firsthand knowledge, you know, for example, Ruby's oldest child, talking to the authorities and the police, for no one to do anything. It's just alarming. And then another comment from C. Wilson. They say, I heard the 911 call from the neighbor. It was heartbreaking. So this was the 911 call, the initial call made to the authorities when the child escaped. And they're saying it was heartbreaking to hear this recorded 911 call. The neighbor broke down crying to the 911 operator. Also, the child told the neighbor to not call the police, saying it was his fault. Interesting. So it sounds like, from what C. Wilson is saying, is that one of the children managed to escape, thank goodness, runs to the neighbor's house, and then the neighbor is helping the child, maybe giving the child water, maybe a snack or something, and is about to call 911, and the child is saying, no, don't call 911. This was all my fault. So maybe the child was thinking, look, I was desperate enough to escape to the neighbors, but I need to get back, or it'll be much worse for me if you call the police. Yeah, and that's pretty normal. Most abuse victims, whether it's a child or a spouse, will at least consider this, if not exhibit this kind of behavior of, no, everything's fine, don't worry about it. One, because they're potentially worried about being abused if they don't do that. But gaslighting is something that actually happens. It happens over a long span of time, and it's in the midst almost always of a high-control abusive relationship in which the victims end up believing that they deserve the abuse. They believe that they can't judge reality. They question their own idea of their own autonomy or their rights. Everything just gets torn down. They believe they're worthless. The abuser will often tell the victim that they're worthless. And so when you, as a victim, are finally able to tell the police or the authorities or something or a therapist, you're still gaslit. You still are brainwashed to believe that you deserve it and that the abuser might be a good presence in your life. And so it complicates things when victims are interviewed initially, and those things need to be considered very carefully. going on here. A. Wong says, I'm not Mormon, but I went to a Mormon-run troubled teen facility in Utah, and a lot of their punishments were very similar to Jody's. It's great that people are finally seeing how these quote-unquote therapists have been training their clients. Treating their clients, yeah, that is pretty awful. All right, Doctors 195 says, as a formal LDS member and someone who lives and is from the town where this happened, I have heard members of her congregation that were greatly concerned for her children, and some did call CPS. Okay, so we're hearing from this individual that this isn't normal necessarily within the Mormon religion or within the community. And not only that, but that many, according to this person, within the congregation did call the authorities. So that's good to hear going on. There are many things that are wrong with Mormon culture that I speak about regularly. I also think there won't be much grace for Ruby Frankie from her neighbors, church, and peers. Okay, so that's also good to hear. Whole Lively says, I was Mormon from birth and was devout for 30 years. We weren't necessarily taught not to question things in the religion. So I was talking in a video about how in some religious groups, you're not allowed to question things. You're not allowed to say, what's going on here? Whereas other religious traditions have a much more robust encouragement and allowance for questioning of the faith. And it's okay to do that. But what this person is saying, I was a Mormon from birth and was devout as a Mormon for 30 years. We weren't necessarily taught not to question things in the religion. In fact, we were almost encouraged to question sometimes. However, the insidious part of all this is that if you didn't get the correct answer to your question, or if you felt like you didn't get any answer at all, the fault lies with you. So even though the Mormon church encouraged questioning, they could never be wrong. Yeah. I didn't know that detail. That's pretty awful. Going on here, last comment here. Allison says, as a former CPS worker, I appreciate your viewpoints. So I was not necessarily defending CPS, but providing a more firsthand account of Child Protective Services, at least in my region, which I imagine is similar to the rest of the country, in that you know, you talk to the average person and they'll believe that either Child Protective Services will, at the first sign of possible abuse, they take your children away for the rest of your life, or they don't do anything, or they participate in abusing the children themselves. Because, you know, there are cases where those things will happen. But when you, you know, aggregate hundreds of thousands of cases, are there going to be some outliers? Yeah. But you don't hear about the success stories because it doesn't make the news. So I was talking about that, and I was talking about how, in my experience, the average Child Protective Service worker was working real hard with very little resources to make a big difference in reducing child abuse and saving children's lives. I mean, they're doing it every day. They're doing it right now. They'll do it in the future. So think what you will, but consider the reality of what CPS workers are going through. You know, and maybe some of you have terrible accounts of Child Protective Services harming you as a child or you as a parent. Those things do happen. I want to recognize that, but it's not the norm in my experience. So getting back to Allison here, as a former CPS worker, I appreciate your viewpoints. I took a position as a caseworker in New York City post 9/11 because I wanted to help people somehow after such a devastating event. We had crazy caseloads, meaning like lots of people that they're in charge of, which of course spreads you very thin. You're probably going to have some cases that you should be monitoring, but you don't have time and something bad happens going on. We had a limited ability to actually help the children and families, and most definitely supervisors and judges overriding our decisions, meaning that the CPS worker wants to advocate for children or wants to take a child out of the house or wants to start investigating. And what Allison is saying is supervisors and judges would actually not allow that to happen. So it was very difficult. A related comment by Jill, they say, I'm a social work student in Utah County where the Frankie family live and have several classmates interning at DCFS, that's Department of Child and Family Services, going on. When we were all looking for our internships, very few students chose to intern at DCFS. It can be demanding and traumatizing to work there, and it's often thankless to work there. Every judgment call that a DCF worker makes has the potential to not only be heavily scrutinized by the legal system, as it should be, but will massively affect a child's future. That is a lot of pressure, and I don't envy anyone who is repeatedly put in that situation. The length of time people work at DCFS is so short because the burnout rate is so high. Yeah, I mean, just imagine that, especially as an intern. You're a social work student, and you know you don't have any experience, and your first job out of the gate is to be in charge of these cases. And I don't know, but I could imagine, since DCFS is already stretched too thin, that when you have an intern that's working for free, then you just give them a lot of cases, and you don't even have time to monitor what's happening. It's like, yeah, just figure it out, because it's not like these agencies have a ton of time and the luxury to really sit with the intern and guide them and help them. So you could imagine that. And but even if they do have some help and some support, just making a judgment call of what do you do in these situations? And it's hard to tell. And what's best for the child? And I think I might have talked about before how, for us on the outside, it might seem like this really simple answer. Well, you just take the kids out of the home. Problem solved. The problem is not solved. A new set of problems begin that might be lesser than leaving them in the house with the abusive parents, but it might actually be worse or a lateral move. For example, I've talked about how I was contracted by the government to go into these homes and provide therapy. These were cases in which the abuses were not severe enough such that the children were taken away permanently. That didn't happen very often. And so they would send me in because, generally speaking, the government doesn't want to separate children from their parents, number one. And number two, they don't have the money to pay to have the children housed. So that's another factor. And number three, they are worried that, okay, if we could pull the children out and that would eliminate the possibility or the risk of being abused by those parents, but we don't necessarily know what's happening in the foster homes. We have a pretty good idea and we have a lot of vetting for those foster parents, but you just never really know, especially when you're thinking about other foster kids that could also be abusing other kids in the house. So it's not like taking them out of the house is going to eliminate the risk of abuses happening. And for the record, I worked alongside a lot of foster parents who are some of the most saintly people on the planet. They're very giving, very altruistic and loving. And, they open their homes to some of the most troubled children on the, in the community. And there's easier ways to make money. People will say, oh, foster parents, they're just in it for the money. I'm going to take a guess and say there's easier ways to make money and less stressful ways. So now, are there bad actors within the foster care community? Yeah. I've heard of those cases, but on average, that's not the case. Anyway, so the other thing is that the separation, from the outside, we don't want the children to be attached to their abusive parents, but unfortunately they are. And so when they're separated, there is an attachment injury that will happen that will be very harmful to the children. Now, that harm might be not as great of a harm as leaving them in the home, but it is a consideration. Best case scenario, we can leave them in the home so the attachment can be retained, but we'll just change the parenting so that it's no longer abusive. And that's where I came in. That's when the government would send me in because, DCFS and Child Protective Services, the social workers, they just were overseers. They didn't actually provide treatment to actually change the individuals. They might provide a little bit here and there, but I was the person that would go into the home and would have several hours to explore and to bond with everyone in the family to get more information and to address whatever it is in the parents that's causing them to be abusive and to offer a different way of parenting. It was a tightrope walking line because if I just came in all guns a-blazing and said, you got to stop, you got to do, then I'd lose the parents. And although they might comply with the treatment, they wouldn't be on board with the therapy. So I had to I had to get them to like me, even though they're being forced to talk to me. Imagine that, a therapist that is forced into the home. Now, they could refuse to see me, but if they refuse to see me for a long enough time, then the children would be taken out of the home. So it was always this threat, or they would be prosecuted more harshly or something like that. So anyway, it's really quite a crime and a injustice that you have these underpaid government workers that are choosing to work in CPS or DCFS because they love children and they're trying to save children. And yet the entire society either believes that, you know, they're just waiting to take children out of the home because that's all CPS wants to do, or they're completely incompetent, horrible human beings that don't care about children. I mean, just imagine, you know, how horrible that would feel. Maybe even people in their family feel that way about them because they've been brainwashed by society. There's so many other things that someone with a graduate degree in social work could do with their life that make more money, less stressful, and isn't stigmatized by the general public. And you know, I've been upset about this since the late 90s, and it still persists to this day. No one's standing up for CPS workers or DCFS workers. It's unfair. It's not okay. Now, getting to the Jody Hildebrandt, Ruby Frankie case and those children, it appears that there were many reports that had been submitted to CPS and the police, you know, prior to the child escaping and the police being called. And yet, seemingly, very little was done. And yeah, that should be looked at. That should definitely be looked at. I don't know the circumstances, and might there be something that we could do on a national level to raise awareness? Is there a cultural problem? Is it a funding thing? Are there politicians involved? Are judges getting in the way? I don't know. Something's wrong there, and it's probably not a unique problem. If I were to put my money down on something that was going on in this particular department in Utah, I would suspect that you had workers there who absolutely did care about children. And, you know, maybe they had some conservative points of view. I would meet some CPS workers who would say things like, yeah, you know, this kid keeps calling all the time, or this family member keeps calling all the time alleging abuse. And, you know, it's just normal parenting stuff. And they just seem to go away. Would I see that? And would I at time, you know, sometimes I'd be like, okay, that sounds like legit. But other times I'd be like, that kind of sounds like you probably should do something. You know, I would hear that sometimes, but it was usually pretty low level allegations. Not the sort of allegations that were being submitted, what I'm guessing to be submitted by the family. Because, you know, the oldest sibling, the oldest child in the Ruby Frankie family had inside information about all the things that were happening. And of course, all the things that were happening with Jody Hildebrandt, I mean, my goodness. So anyway, so if I was to take a guess, I would say that maybe you had some right-leaning CPS workers in Utah. That wouldn't be hard to imagine. And probably overworked and underfunded. That's often the case by default. Maybe, if I was to take a guess, there was some movement to do something about it, because there were several, according to the reporting, CPS had visited the home something like 15 times. So there was some looking into it. Might they have been convinced by Ruby and Kevin's charm? Was there racism involved? Because it's like they're a privileged white blonde family. So it's like, well, they're pure. They don't abuse children. I'm going to believe them. Could that be a part of it? Absolutely. But I don't know, just given all the evidence and that it's videotaped by the parents and posting on the internet, it's just hard to believe that there wasn't enough there to do something. I mean, because that's the thing, like there's taking the kids out of the home, but then there's like sending a therapist in the home. I mean, that was usually something they did well before they took the kids out of the home. They're like, well, let's send a therapist in. It's a lot cheaper to pay for a therapist, even though I wasn't cheap, but a lot cheaper than housing the child and especially several children in several foster homes. That can be very expensive. We're not hearing that CPS did anything. They investigated, but they didn't require parenting classes. They didn't require therapy. Apparently, we don't know. But so there's something's going on there. It's either a cultural thing in that particular government office, or there's a judge getting in the way, or a police, or a supervisor. Something's going wrong there. And that is a problem, because you just think about all the other families in their area that have been overlooked and not responded to. You're just going to take a guess. And then you think, well, if that office had a problem, are other offices having problems of a similar nature, which we could imagine? And if that's true, then just think about all the people that are being abused, children that are being abused. And even when the authorities are contacted, nothing happens. And I've ran into that myself. One of the very first clients I had disclosed to me that she was being abused by her parents, I was so happy that she told me, because at first she didn't really want to tell me. And I was like, hey, you can tell me whatever you want to tell me. And I eventually got her to open up, and she told me, and it was really congratulating her. And I said, okay, we're going to call the authorities, because I told her that. I said, just remind you, if you tell me something along these lines, I have to report it. And so when she told me this information, she was basically saying, and now let's tell the authorities. And so, I was so happy for her, and I just was commending her. I was sad that everything was happening, but I thought, now begins the healing process. Now begins the road to safety. We call CPS together. Long story short, it's investigation, blah, blah, blah. CPS did nothing. And here I am, just a bystander on this whole thing, and thinking, oh, wait, what? Not only is there a child, but you have a therapist that's vouching for all this information. What's going on here? It was very disillusioning, but I was a young therapist and needed that education. I learned the hard way that it depends on the situation. There's a threshold, and not every CPS worker is the same, blah, blah, blah. So now I'm going to contrast that with countless other cases in which CPS did exactly the right thing, working very hard without anyone thanking them, working night and day with a huge caseload, and absolutely saving children's lives. There were many cases where I was working with a family and the parents were abusive or neglectful because of usually drug use. And when one report comes through, and it might even be a little bit of a vague report, CPS looks into it and they discover that it's this very abusive situation for the children. They instantly take the children out of the home. They problem solve, lots of team meetings with therapists and community members, family members, aunts and uncles, other CPS workers, lots of effort to work with the family and figure out what's best for the children. A decision is made, and then monitoring over time. Countless situations that I've been a part of have been observant of the government doing those kinds of things. Going to the police and having to convince the police of, hey, this is a situation. The police push back, maybe. And DCFS says, no, we got to take it seriously. These kids matter. They go to court. You have a judge that is a little ornery, pushes back. And DCFS and the social workers are trying really hard to fight against the judge, saying, no, we have to do this, because the judge is listening to the parents and to the department and trying to figure out what to do. And some parents can be very convincing. Some judges are biased. And, the CPS worker is like, no, judge, please, and really pleading and trying to bring the best case forward. And, so that's my observation. So, yeah, it's just heartbreaking to think about the kids and all that they've been through, and that it was just happening right underneath our noses. And we just completely failed those children. I feel somehow personally responsible for it. And it's very, very upsetting. It's one thing when you have abuse happening behind closed doors, there's no video cameras, there's no YouTube channel. It'd be hard to know it was happening. But if it's on the internet and you're hearing all these statements from Jody and from Ruby and you have these videos, and it's just, I can't imagine how angry these kids would be, especially that oldest kid. How angry, how rageful they would be. It's like, we've been telling everyone, the authorities, the public, YouTube, we've been telling YouTube about these things, and nothing happened until the abuse had to become so bad that a young child, to survive, just to survive the night, had to escape the torture and imprisonment of duct tape and ropes and wounds and emaciation and neglect, and run to a neighbor's house just to get some food and water, and yet still says to the neighbor, don't call the police. No, it's my fault. These wounds are my fault. I mean, the rage that these victims and all victims should be having right now. I mean, it's upsetting. I watch a lot of upsetting stuff on this channel. This is quite possibly one of the most upsetting things. Children are innocent. They're pure. They're good. Yeah, kids can be bad at times, but they're helpless and they can't defend themselves from physical, emotional, mental, sexual abuse. That in today's day and age, we don't have a way. Even though we have the way, we don't use the way to protect those children. Because, you know, in my world, the big problem is people never call CPS, or they wait too long or something. And that doesn't appear to be the case here. They did everything that they were supposed to do. The aunts, I think Ruby Frankie's sisters, Ruby Frankie's oldest child, the daughter, apparently, according to reporting, had all been reporting, which was a very brave, courageous thing to do. And yet nothing happened, and the children continued to be abused. And abused 10 times over, maybe 100 times over with Jody Hildebrand. It's really upsetting. Well, I'm sure there will be a lot more news coverage coming out in the future, but I don't know. I will tell you, I'm very curious. I didn't show this clip, but the lawyer, Kevin's attorney, said that every time the attorney looks in and investigators look in it, because, you know, the attorney has all the information. And so as things start to be uncovered and new information is coming out, it just is blossoming and cascading into this huge web of potential crimes or problems and abuses that Jody Hildebrand has been involved in for a long time. And we heard a little bit about it. It's just like the potential brainwashing of Kevin. I was talking with my wife about this earlier, that this might be the first case in which you have a licensed therapist who is a charismatic leader of a cult. This is the first therapist cult leader that I can think of. I'm sure that there have been others, or at least high-control therapists, but certainly this is maybe one of the most salacious or dramatic stories, the most famous story. I can't think of another one off the top of my head, but certainly, you know, you've had self-help gurus like Teal Swan and those sort of people, but not a licensed clinician, licensed by the government and educated in the same graduate schools that a lot of other clinicians have been educated in. I can't think of another story like that. And that's, it almost makes me worry that this won't be the last time this will happen. Because, of course, therapists have power and they have access to people and they have the backing of society and the government and their credentials. And given social media and everything, it just seems like this is going to happen again. That's also upsetting because people already think we're all idiots and I don't need this as well, adding to it, you know. Obviously not everyone thinks that we're idiots, but a lot of people do. At the very least, it's just really upsetting and enraging to think about someone who is given the power. You know, because to be a therapist, you are given privilege and power just by your license, by your credentials, by your position. People come to my office and I have to consider that power dynamic very carefully and not use it in a harmful way. And most therapists are very careful about that. You know, in an earlier video, I was talking about how all the therapists in my circle, and by my circle, I'm talking about all the students I work with, all the colleagues, and, you know, I'm talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of therapists that I know of, that because they're so concerned about abusing or exploiting a client, that they won't even suggest that the client leave a review for them. You know, never mind, you know, the way that Jody Hildebrand was like, you better leave me a 5-star review. All the therapists that I know, or at least most of them, would be loath to even suggest to a client that they review them online because they don't want to exploit that. They don't want to pressure a client to leave them a positive review or a review at all. And of course, it is explicitly mentioned in our ethical codes that we are to be very, very careful about that. And when in doubt, we can't even suggest that someone review us. You know, normally for us therapists, we're maybe overly paranoid at times about exploitation of clients. And yet you have some therapists who not only do those kinds of things, like you will give me a 5-star review, but they go way beyond that. You know, it's just very contrasting with the rest of us. It's upsetting. All right. Well, that is it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Everyone, please take care of yourself, truly. And let's do what we can to help children in our society and really around the world, because we deserve it and the children deserve it.